One of the top challenges for people seeking employment and education is access to reliable transportation. That's why Well-Built Bikes refurbishes donated bicycles and provides them to struggling community members. If you have an old or unused bike that you can donate to their cause, it could provide mobility and independence to someone who can't afford a car or a brand new bike of their own. Visit BikeShopTampa.com to learn more, or swing by the Well-Built Bike store in the University Mall on Fowler Avenue.
Well, welcome once again to another Work Ethic Podcast, and I'm really excited about today's guest. I've got my old friend Mark Lieb here with me, and man, I'm one. So I've known this brother for some time. Used to work with us, volunteer quite a while with the Well, and So I'll tell you what. So I'm going to start out with just kind of the top line things, like we do, like kind of like right off of your, almost like off of your LinkedIn, right? So. Mark is, so you are a, you teach at USF, you're a professor at USF, and you teach fiction, playwriting, screenwriting, but also you've been producing and writing plays, I mean, I think for as long as I've been alive, right? Since like 1980, you've had, my understanding is you have plays across the nation, New York, Boston, Chicago, here in kind of Tampa, St. Pete area. I've been able to go to several plays and readings, and Mark, I've been blown away by your work.
Thank you.
I think you're brilliant. I think you're brave. I think like there's a lot of things that I've come away with some of your shows and just been like, you do remarkable work, and I'm grateful. Thank you for the work that you do. I've been surveying lots of people on this show, trying to like really pick at like our relationship to work and whether people are employed, unemployed, whatever, every walk of life, because I just think that's something like central to like humanity. But I think the place of artists and creator is something particularly important in this kind of exploration. And so I'll tell you what, I'll just toss you the ball and let you introduce yourself to everybody, and then we'll just kind of wrap from there.
All right, thank you. I was born in Tampa. My father was born in Tampa, where some of the few who have been born here and didn't move here from somewhere else. I went to local schools, Plant High School, and when I graduated, I went to Harvard University in Cambridge as an undergraduate. I assumed I was going to become a lawyer because I had been essentially told by my parents that one became either a lawyer or a doctor.
Did they do that?
No.
No.
My father was a businessman with a department store in Ybor City. At a time when Ybor City was thriving, but not like it is now. And he basically let me know that I could do anything I wanted. Mm. Well, what I really wanted to do was to write.
Always.
But mm-hmm. I didn't know that you could do so successfully as a job.
And like feed yourself.
Yeah, and feed yourself.
Yeah.
In fact, I was more right about that than I guessed at the time. So when I was at Harvard, I spent a lot of time around literary magazines and doing a lot of writing. And by the time I got out, I was convinced that I wanted to be a full-time writer, which is a silly thing to think because it's extremely difficult to make a living as a full-time writer. There are probably a handful of people who do, and most people don't come anywhere near making a living from their writing. Anyway, I didn't know this at the time. So I had a fellowship to study abroad, and I chose the University of Bristol in England, which had a theater department, which was fabled in England. And I saw my first play, or part of my first play, put up on stage there, and I loved it. So the idea of playwriting was really exciting to me. And I came back to the United States in 1976, and for a year tried to survive as a freelance writer. And I couldn't do it, and I realized that I needed more training. So I applied to and somehow got into the Yale School of Drama in their playwriting major. Hmm. I spent 3 years at Yale, got an MFA in 1980, and I had written a play there called Terry by Terry, which was a big success, I'm happy to say. When I wrote it, I didn't know it would be a big success. In fact, to be honest, I was so in doubt about it that I was ready to throw it away before showing it to anybody. I thought it was so bad. And then I showed it to someone, and they loved it, and we put it up in classes, and they loved it. And then the head of the Yale School of Drama, who was also about to become the head of the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, said, we want to do your play as our first new American play at the American Repertory Theater. I was 25 when he said that to
Jeez.
Me. So I had my first major production of a play in 1980 in a 550-seat theater.
Wow.
And we sold out, and we had to extend the run. And I thought, oh, so this is what life is like. You just write these plays, and everybody loves them, and you just surf happily to the end of your life.
Quite the set point. Yeah,
yes.
Quite.
Little did I know. So over the next 10 years, I lived in Cambridge. But I only did two more plays for the American Repertory Theater, and both were adaptations. One of Beaumarchais' The Marriage of Figaro, the original French play from which the opera was taken, and the other of Chekhov's very first play, Platonov. I did an English version. But meanwhile, I was totally befuddled by my next full-length play entirely from me, and I spent years on it and couldn't make it work.
Hmm.
And in the meantime, I did a little journalism. Wrote for the Boston Review, wrote for a PBS series on characters in drama, but I was basically using the time to teach. I was asked in 1981 to start teaching playwriting at Harvard Extension School, which is Harvard's adult education. So I was teaching three times a week, I can't remember whether it was two or three times a week, and making a little money that way. And working week after week after week, late into the night, on a play that just would not work, no matter what I did to it. It was called The Encyclopedia Culpepper. And finally, in my last year in Cambridge, or in the Boston area, I was asked to be the first playwriting instructor at the Institute for Advanced Theater Study at Harvard. So that paid better and gave me more contact with students. But at the same time, I was getting tired of Cambridge. I was getting tired of the Boston area, the winters, and the fact that it was very difficult to make friends with people who were not on their way somewhere else. And I
interesting.
Yeah, because everybody's in university.
Launching out of there, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're all launching. They're all going somewhere. So I decided to return to my hometown of Tampa, where, after all, I have family. My mother was still alive at the time. My sister still is around. She's an attorney. And I had cousins and so on.
So she did what she was told.
she did what I was told.
Okay.
And she's told me she did it in order that she could get the merit that I was supposed to get.
You just left it laying there.
I just left it there.
Snatched your birthright up.
She took it and she ran with it.
All right.
And she had a very successful career.
That's awesome.
So I came back and I tried to get teaching jobs in Tampa. And people looked at my resume, and they looked at these labels, Harvard and Yale.
Overqualified.
And they didn't say overqualified.
Oh, okay.
They said, great labels, but we don't have money just lying around waiting for a professor.
Oh.
You have no chance of getting involved until someone dies or retires.
Oh, interesting.
So I went about 3 years doing temporary work, doing anything I could find, until finally USF asked me to teach screenwriting.
Okay.
And after they asked me to teach screenwriting, they moved me over to the theater department to teach playwriting.
Mm-hmm.
And after they did that, they moved me over to the English department, where I've been for a long time now. And there I started teaching four classes a year. Playwriting, screenwriting, intro to drama, modern drama, intro to literature. And I love teaching. So that was a lot of fun and began to bring in something like an income. It still wasn't enough income because I was an adjunct, and adjuncts aren't paid very well.
Right.
Eventually, though, the head of the English department, Hunt Hawkins, let me know that there was a position opening up for a full-time professor, not tenure track, but full-time nonetheless.
Mm-hmm.
And he suggested that I apply for it, and I did, and I got it. And for the last, let's say, 9 years or so, I've been a full-time professor at USF, which is very helpful because, meanwhile, my writing career was going through ups and downs, something like the roller coaster at the Florida State Fair.
Mm.
When it was up, it was terrific. It seemed that I could do no wrong. It would be followed by a plummet the next year where nobody wanted one of my plays, where nobody wanted one of my essays, and if I hadn't had the university job, I would have gone broke on the writing.
Mm.
This, for example, is a very good year, thank God. It's a year when I'm having a play and a novel come out. But
My
main source of income besides teaching was not writing plays or novels or short stories. It was writing theater reviews for Creative Loafing. I was hired in 1998 to become the chief theater critic for Creative Loafing, and which at the time was a fairly important arts and politics newspaper. I don't know that it's as important now as it was 20 years ago. I still see it around much, but it used to be everywhere. Yeah. Now it's in some places and not others. But for 20 years, I saw about 50 plays a year, all free. Brought my wife with me every time, and she could walk out at an intermission and say, I'll meet you in the restaurant. I don't want to go through the second act of this.
But you had to stay.
But I had to stay. But I saw more good stuff than bad stuff.
Yeah.
And I wrote 20 years worth of reviews, which I figure is about 1,000 reviews. And during that time, I was lucky enough to win 7 awards for excellence from the Society of Professional Journalists, which was good because, not just because I was winning an award, but because it was my fellow journalists telling me that they thought what I was doing was valuable.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very, very helpful, and it added to my income from the teaching. And I had a work method, which was during the week, I focused on my students and on my own playwriting. On the weekend, I would go on a Saturday night or a Sunday afternoon and see a show, and then I'd spend the rest of Sunday writing the review.
Mm.
I would turn the review in late Sunday night and then go back to teaching on Monday.
Mm.
The reviews, when they started, were 1,300 words, which is a fair amount on a deadline, you know, with only a few hours to write the thing.
Yep.
And by the time the paper went through several publishers and changed their attitude about advertising, it was down to 750 words per column. But it was fun, and it was challenging, and I would sit there at my computer with the blank screen, and I would think, all right, I've got to write a decent English essay about the play that I saw last night. Because if I don't write a decent English essay, 50,000 people are going to know it. Mm. They're going to know that I screwed up and that I can't handle the language. So I had a special pressure on me, but I think I survived and maybe even succeeded.
Wow, man. So there's so many things to pick through in there. I want to talk about this play coming up, but I do have a question real quick, because you're writing, all this writing you're doing is kind of theater review.
Right.
But I remember you wrote an article about The Well.
Right.
For Creative Loafing. So how did that come about? I mean, I know you offered, like, yes, hey, I know what's going on here, but were you writing other things as well at that point?
That's a great question. It brings me to a motivation which has to do not only with those articles I wrote about The Well and about people going hungry in Tampa. Yep. But with some of my recent writing as well. And that is that I'm Jewish, and over the years I've become much more religious and have spent much more time studying religious texts and Torah and commentaries and Talmud than I ever did when I was in my 20s.
Mm.
And as I studied and learned and practiced, I saw that from the biblical standpoint, God cares a lot about social justice.
Yeah.
That it's not just something that's mentioned along with 100 other things.
It's like core. It's core to the document.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like all theology is liberation theology.
That's right.
So I thought I'd like to do something aside from just review theater plays. And I thought, well, what can I do? And I looked for some areas where I might be able to write an essay or write an article. One of them was about The Well and the good deeds that it was doing for the homeless. And I asked my editor if I could do it, and after some no's, he finally said yes.
Mm.
And then after I'd written that article, I wanted to write an article about hunger in Tampa, about how many people were going without meals in Tampa on a regular basis, not just those who were coming to The Well where you were doing such beautiful work, but people all around the area. And at first I got resistance because my editor felt it was too well known. It wasn't a subject that they needed to do a new article about.
Oh, everybody knows everybody's hungry.
Yeah. But eventually he said, go for it.
Okay.
And I wrote a long cover story about hungry in Tampa.
Hmm.
But I didn't, you're right. I stretched out beyond the theater reviews, but I never found a regular platform from which to talk social justice.
Interesting. And they allowed you you didn't get the whole stay in your lane thing. They were like, you've built up enough credibility as a writer here that we trust you to.
Yeah, they didn't doubt my ability as a writer. They just wondered whether the subject matter was of sufficient interest to the readership.
Yeah.
But I think it was.
I do too. And well, why don't we talk a little bit about? There's a million things in what you've already said that I want to run through, but I really want you to tell, because you have a play coming out like March. Now, like very soon,
in a month.
And so, tell us about it.
All right, let me just add one last thing.
Sure.
So I don't slight my students. I've also been writing short stories and a novel during that time that I was getting away from creative loafing. I was still writing plays, but I turned to the short story and to the novel. And maybe later we can talk about that.
Absolutely.
But now getting to the play. I wanted to do something that fulfilled two demands.
Okay.
One, the social justice demand that I'd learned about from studying Torah and Talmud and commentaries. Another that had to do with Tampa.
Yeah.
My wife has been telling me for years, write about Tampa. You're not in Boston anymore. Mm. Write about your hometown. And I thought, is there something of sufficient gravitas in Tampa where it's worth a play? Mm. You know, there's a lot of Tampa history, which is about Bolita and running numbers and prohibition and gangsters and Santo Trafficante. I didn't want to write about that.
Sure.
We've got Robert De Niro to make those movies.
And there's a lot written about it already. Yeah.
And there's a lot written
about it. Scott Deaches, I say. Yeah, a lot of work's been done on a lot of that. Fascinating history.
Yeah, it is fascinating history.
It is, yeah.
But I wanted to see if there was a social justice issue somewhere in Tampa that I could write about. And I read a book called From Saloons to Steakhouses by Andrew T. Huse, H-U-S-E. Is a history of Tampa, and one of the chapters was about the sit-ins that desegregated the lunch counters in downtown Tampa in 1960. And I read that chapter and I said, this is it. I can write a play about this. It's going to be a little demanding because it was a group effort and most theaters can't afford too many actors. Mm. So it'd be sort of tough to turn into a drama, but this is the social justice issue that involves my city and that I should be writing about. So I went over to Stageworks and Carla Hartley, who is the artistic director there and is a person committed to producing plays where social justice matters. Yep. She really is, more so than most other theaters.
Carla's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. She's also a great director. I mean, a brilliant director and a good friend. But she's also very canny about what she will and will not do at Stageworks. Mm. So I knew I didn't have a sure thing by any means. I went to her and I said, let's have a drink outside in the courtyard near your theater. And I pitched the idea to her. And she listened, the idea about a play about the lunch counter desegregation in 1960. She listened for 5-10 minutes. She said, yes, I'll commission it. So she essentially commissioned me, this was 2020, I think, to, it was either 2020 or 2021. Let me see if I remember. I guess it was 2021. Yes. She commissioned
me. Those years became a blur for so many of us, man.
That's right.
Yeah.
She commissioned me to go ahead and write the play, and we would do a staged reading of it after I got a version done. Then I'd go back and make changes, revisions. Then we'd do another reading of it, a table reading. And at that point, if it was ready, she was prepared to put it on in 2023. She had enough faith in me, I must say, to basically schedule it for March 2023, way back in summer 2021.
Mm.
So I set out to write the play. I did a lot of research. I talked with people who had been involved in the desegregation of the lunch counters. I read a lot of history. I got onto a wonderful site, because I think it's called newspapers.com, but I can't remember for sure now because it's been months since I did it. But it allows you for a fee to access any newspaper in the country from the last 100 years.
No way.
It's true.
Oh, so, I got to get on that.
It's great. All right. And I found all the news reports of the sit-ins as they were happening.
That's gold.
It was great. I couldn't believe it. It was quotes from all the people involved. It was editorials by the Tribune. One of the most shocking and dismaying editorials was the Tribune. At a time when blacks were not allowed into movie theaters, bowling alleys, public beaches, and hotels, the Tampa Tribune said in response to the sit-ins, we have no race problem in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, okay, the guy who wrote that editorial may not have a race problem, but some tens of thousands of people living in your city do have a race problem.
And some of the old Tampa Tribune articles are unbelievable in their so I don't know them from this history, but I did a bunch of research on it was some of the old like citizens committees, like further back, like cattle families and things like that. And like, I mean, some of it's actually crazy reading some of the Tampa Tribune stuff where I'm like, oh, this was just like it's, I guess this still happens with news, but it was so clear and explicit, right? I guess that's the benefit of retrospect. So yeah, so you can find these articles saying, yeah, there's no problem there.
Right.
There's no problem.
There was an enormous problem.
Yeah.
I even found the young man, Clarence Fort, who at age 20 or 21 started the sit-ins in 1960. He's still alive. And I was able to get his phone number and interview him about what he'd gone through.
Is he here, still here locally?
He is still here locally.
Amazing.
The head of the NAACP in Florida was a guy named A. Leon Lowry, a reverend, who was one of Martin Luther King's teachers in Atlanta when Martin Luther King was a young man just going through college. Hmm. And he, unfortunately, was deceased, so I couldn't interview him, but I did get to talk to his second wife and learn some things about him from her. So that was useful. I finished the play, or let's say a draft of the play, a good enough draft where I was willing to show it to Carla, in 2021. It started in 2021, so I finished it in 2022, and we did a staged reading early in 2022. After the staged reading, we had an audience talk back, and it was clear to me that I had failed to introduce into the story the forces of evil, that the Klan and people like the Klan were missing from the play, and that I needed to put it in for the play to be more effective and for it to work. So I went back to the drawing board and spent several months, including time researching the Ku Klux Klan and gaining the most from interviews, wonderful interviews with Klan members about what they believed.
Really?
Yeah, it was just great. And by the way, there were no brilliant Klan members. These guys were rednecks in the worst way.
Yeah.
They were vicious, nasty, and stupid, which is hard to beat.
Yeah.
At least intelligent people you can bargain with.
Mm-hmm.
These people were too stupid to bargain.
Mm.
So I finally got a pretty good grasp, I thought, on what the Klan believed. I went back and wrote some scenes with the Klan. And then we did a table reading in late 22 with Chris Jackson, the director, who's going to direct it next month, in charge of the reading. This time he was in charge, not Carla, but Carla sat in. We had paid actors doing this reading, and then we had a talk back from the actors and the director and the dramaturg, whose name is Gigi Genowine, and a very smart woman, and from Carla. And this time the reaction was stronger, but it was clear to me that I had to go even further with the bad guys.
Really?
Yeah, that I had kept them away from the play too long, and when I brought them in, I didn't bring them in as much as I could.
Interesting.
So, and also there was some possibility I saw that I could cut the play a bit. It's two acts. It probably goes an hour and 45 minutes in two acts. So I went back to the drawing board yet again, which is not unusual. As David Mamet says, plays aren't written, they're rewritten.
Mm.
And I did another version, and this one I'm happy with. And they've had it in their hands. Chris, the director, and Carla, the artistic director, have had it. And I worked closely, I should say, with Gigi Genowine, the dramaturg. She had some objections, which we fought about. We went to a restaurant on Fowler Avenue, and she told me why she thought that such and such had happened in scene six, and I told her why she was wrong. And then, and then we bargained all through dinner. And she won a lot of those arguments.
Wow.
She was able to convince me. So,
let me, like, for the sake of like this conversation around this, because I do really want to even take this section of the show. I want to try to like get people to the show, right? I want to help advertise this, and also like for those listening. Mark and I have been talking, and I actually got to, was it the first?
You
reading?
Were the first stage reading, yeah.
The first reading where you realize there's not enough evil. It was such a powerful reading, and I can't wait to see this play. And so then, you know, it'd been a little while since we'd caught up. And, you know, the Well is started putting together this, like, we have an opportunity to build a couple cohorts over the next year with really Tampa focused. We're going to do a lot of Tampa history stuff. These are like what I would say are Tampa builders. And what I mean by builders are not like housing builders,
right?
But builders of community, people that are building meaningful things, things that maybe aren't part of the Well's work, but we recognize like we're cut from the same cloth. These are peers. These are people doing meaningful work in the city. And we have an opportunity to build this cohort. So we've got a group of 20 to 25 folks that we've kind of handpicked,
right,
that we've like invited into what we're calling the 813 Collective. And I want to do, like, we're going to, you know, do a lot of stuff with them to help build up kind of self and self-efficacy for themselves and kind of their own work and, like, you know, mutual aid and support around their mission and what they're doing,
right,
in the city. But love for the city is a huge piece of this. And Tampa history is something that I've been digging into deeply because I think that there's a lot in our history that is instructional to our future, right? Where we've come from has a lot to do with kind of where we're headed, and it helps make sense of some things that are going on even in the city now. And as I thought about, like, okay, what can we do in Tampa? What can I introduce them to? I just kept coming back to this reading. So for those listening, I called Mark and I said, hey, do you think we could do the reading? Could we read it to them? And he said, actually, it comes out in March, which happens to be when we're kicking this off as well. So we've actually been talking with you and StageWorks and been able to kind of work out. I think we settled on the 30th.
Yep.
And I know that's not a night you guys were normally doing, but the stage is all set up. So we've worked out to kind of do a screening for the Well and kind of our friends and people, which I really want to invite everybody to, not everybody, we're bringing out the 813 Collective, but there are some extra seats. We are considering making those available. We're going to maybe sell some of those, or we have some ways that folks can come and join us for that.
Great.
It sounds like you're gonna be there as well to help do like a little talk back or, sure, something at the end of the show. Really excited about that. I want to invite folks to join us for that. But then also if that night, whether they can't come with us because of the night or because of the way that we make tickets available or something, or how many are available, that show will be running at StageWorks for how long and when?
It starts on, the preview is the 16th of March.
The 16th.
Opening night is March 17th, Friday.
March 17th, okay.
And then it runs for 3 weekends, Friday through Sunday.
Okay.
So I think it ends...
And it's every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday for those weekends.
Yeah, every Friday night, Saturday matinee, Saturday night, and Sunday matinee for 3 weekends. And you're coming on the 30th, which I think is Thursday.
Thursday night, yeah. So I had already set up the kind of calendar, and thank you so much for working with us and, sure, helping make that happen. But guys, I've had a chance to sit in on this a little bit, and man, it is... And to know, like, you've gone through so many iterations now, I'm like, it's not the same play. I mean, obviously same history,
yeah,
same narrative, the same story. And honestly, even stuff like the Lowry character, I'm like, this is such an important Tampa history figure,
yeah,
that and I don't know anything about.
Right, and the Klan tried to kill him.
There was so much in there, really.
Yeah, someone took a shot into his bedroom window one night when he was there in his bedroom with his wife. They knew where his bedroom was, and this was during the desegregation of the lunch counters. Someone literally tried to assassinate him and his wife both. And the reason that it seems particularly clear that it was an objection to his work with the desegregation is that Harry T. Moore was the head of the NAACP before Lowry. Mm. And he lived in a place called Mims, Florida, which is on the East Coast. And on Christmas night, I forget the date, 50-something, someone put a bomb under his house and killed him and his wife December 25th in the evening.
On Christmas,
because he was the head of the NAACP in Florida. That's the job that A. Leon Lowry took, knowing what had happened to his predecessor. And when they took shots at him, it wasn't the first time something like that had happened.
Now, he was from Tampa? He had been here?
No, he was born elsewhere. He
came here to organize and...
He came here to organize and to be a reverend at a particular... the Beulah Baptist Church, I think it was.
And you said that he was a teacher of King in some fashion?
He was a teacher of Martin Luther King.
In what capacity?
I think it was Morehouse College, and I can't remember what the subject matter was.
Technically, he taught one of his classes or something like that. Yep. So, obviously, I think that, I want to emphasize to everybody to make a point to come out to this play, but obviously, you put a lot of work into this, but like you said, I had two demands that I started. I was like, I want to do something about Tampa, and I want to do something about social justice. It seems like you found a really powerful kind of overlap of these stories. What is your hope for, I almost think, and I don't know, maybe you speak to what's the, I don't even know how to ask this. So in my mind, I think when you write, you kind of are you familiar with Dorothy Sayers?
Sure.
And you know
Lord
the
Peter
essay,
Wimsey.
Why Work?
No, I don't know that essay.
So, by the way, it's actually a huge piece of how this show even came to be. It's one of my favorite essays. But she talks about as a playwright in it, and she's like, if you want to fail as a playwright, she's talking about anything, but she uses that as an illustration. She's like, if you want to fail at, so she makes the case that people say they're serving the community. She's like, when you try to serve the community is not served. She's like, what you need to do is serve the work. And let the work serve the community.
Right.
And so she talks about if you keep looking up to see how people take it or try to give them what they want, you end up creating inauthentic work or something like that, right? And she makes this really powerful case, and it's pretty scathing actually against the church doing such a poor job of being faithful to the work,
right.
Because it's got a message or something like that.
Yeah.
It's a pretty scathing critique of that. But in any case, I'm bringing all that up to say I'm taking a lead from her to say there's something that is you pour your heart and soul into the work itself. Mm-hmm. But now that it's time to show it, it's time to I imagine there is some now hope for or relationship to audience that I'm curious in terms of intent and impact and hoped for experience or something like that. I just love to hear what your thoughts around that are.
Well, we should say the name of the play. I'll never mention.
Thank you. Yeah,
is When the Righteous Triumph, mm-hmm. which is from Psalms. It's a line from Psalms, but I think the idea is for much of the 20th century.
We got some sirens. It's all good.
For much of the 20th century, something that Baudelaire, the poet, said seemed to be in effect for artists. He said, "The man of literature is the enemy of the world."
Okay.
And for a lot of artists, that was true. Whether it was Scott Fitzgerald trying to show the underside of the American dream, or whether it was William Burroughs trying to show the underside of the life of the mind, or whether it was Marcel Duchamp putting a urinal in a museum and calling it Fountain as if it were a work of art, the artist seemed to be an iconoclast. He seemed to be someone whose job was to shock the audience and to undermine their dearest beliefs.
Mm.
That, I think, climaxed sometime in the 1960s or the 1970s, certainly not beyond. And art, which exists just to disturb people and tell them that their deepest beliefs are wrong, is not of interest to me anymore. It was when I started out. My first successful play was very much about someone who was a shocker and who did everything wrong and who was an anti-hero. At this time, I don't want to write about villains. Mm-hmm. I want to write about heroes.
This is why they were absent in the first reading, maybe? That there is not the...
Oh, yeah. I hadn't thought of that. Maybe that is it.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought enough about showing the bad side.
Yeah.
So what I want to do now is I want to write pieces like When the Righteous Triumph, which serve the community, but serve it honestly.
Yeah.
I don't want to, I don't want to lie, no hypocrisy, no glossing over or sugaring over. I have as much attachment to telling the truth as I ever did.
It's awesome.
But I want it to be things that will be of use to people.
Yeah.
And something that if I had walked into the theater age 21 and saw this particular play, I would walk out illuminated.
Yeah.
I want to write the plays that I wish I had seen when I was 21 and looking for some sort of knowledge of the world.
You know, I even at the reading came out and thought, I wish all my friends have seen this. And I intend to try to bring them to it for exactly that reason. Like, I know those listening kind of have to take my word for it here, having like listened, but I'm like, you want to get out to this and you want to bring your people out to this. It is one of those things that, like, when you see it, you will kick yourself later for not having brought the people that are dear to you and important to you, that especially Tampa folks.
And I want people in Tampa to know where they've come from.
That's right.
In 1960, if you were black, you could not sit down at a luncheonette counter and order a coffee. You would not be allowed to. You would be thrown out. And this was true not only at one counter, it was true at all the counters in downtown Tampa.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Woolworth's, Kress, Moss Brothers, Walgreens, Liggett Rexall, you name it. Morrison's Cafeteria, they would not serve they would not allow a black person to sit down. And Clarence Fort said this is unacceptable. There were some sit-ins going on in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And Tampa barber Clarence Fort, whom nobody had ever heard of, went to the NAACP and said, let's do a sit-in. And the NAACP said, no, we can't do it because we're making progress through the courts. We're not involved in any of these demonstrations involving lots of bodies. And Clarence Fort said, I'm going to do it anyway.
Mm.
And he went and he started it, and within a day or two, the NAACP changed their tune and said, we're behind you all the way, and now Reverend Lowry's going to help. It's an amazing story. It's about a store that's still there. You can drive down Franklin Street in Tampa right now and still see the Woolworth sign. It's empty. There's nothing going on there. It's going to be torn down, I assume, one day.
Where is that exactly? On Franklin?
It's on Franklin.
By the hub?
Yes, right by the hub.
Okay.
Across the street from the hub.
Across the street.
Yeah. That corner
like
is
the hub Woolworth. And Tampa Theater right there.
Right.
Yep. Okay. It still says Woolworths.
It still says Woolworths.
Oh, I got to take a look at that. I didn't realize that's going to be helpful information as well, just visualizing that.
There's one other thing that I want to mention.
Please.
Which is I was a child in Tampa in 1960. I was 6 years old. And I remember Woolworths as a bustling, busy place.
Yeah.
And so was Kress, and so was Moss Brothers, et cetera. So that was going on. The segregation and the discrimination was going on when I was a kid in Tampa.
Yep.
And I must admit that I had an anger against Tampa because it was so bigoted when I was growing up here. I knew it was wrong. Didn't know that I could do anything about it. I knew it was wrong. It was embarrassing. And when I left for Boston to go to college, I thought I'd never come back to Tampa. I was so dissatisfied with it. When I came back finally in 1990, it had changed so much. There's so much about Tampa that I like right now.
Because you left Tampa
in 71.
71.
And spent most of the next 20 years in either Boston or in New Haven.
Now, if it's okay to use this as a point, because you're talking about growing up in Tampa at the same time,
right.
Use this as a bit of a transition to ask you about some of the things you talked about earlier on. The first thing that comes to mind is you said dad was a businessman and owned a department store in Ybor.
Right.
Can you say more about what, like...
My father was in business with his brother and their father, my grandfather. So it was my grandfather, Manuel Leibovitz, and my father, Lester and Walter Lieb. They changed their name at some point. They took off the Ovitz.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So when I was a kid, everything revolved around what we called the store. It was the Sunshine Department Store. And what had happened is that a lot of Romanian Jews had moved to America and had somehow all ended up in Tampa. And they made 7th Avenue a street of Romanian Jewish department stores. So you had Louis Department Store on 19th Street and Sunshine Department Store on 7th and 18th Street.
Interesting.
And so on, and Buckman's Department Store and so on. It was...
Years? Because this is grandpa and father.
Yeah.
So this is like...
I think my grandfather started the store in the 20s.
20s
or 30s. But
yeah.
Yeah, really early. And I would go to work for my father every Christmas season because they'd have so many customers, they needed extra workers. And I would also work summers there. I didn't like working there. I found it boring.
Okay.
I didn't mind waiting on people. I had no objection to that. In fact, if there'd been more business, I would have been happier because at least then I was doing something. But to stand there on the aisle waiting for a customer was, as far as I could see, the most boring thing a person could do in life. And I would come up with, I would take a coin, a penny, and come up with games, baseball games to play. If you get two tails and a head, it's a single. If you get two heads and a tail, it's a double. And I would just try to pass the time as best I could.
Yeah. How old are you at this point?
I started probably when I was 10 or 11.
So this is a question I try to ask most of the people that come on, and this may be the answer, but yeah. I suspect there may be older answers. So, like, what is, if you said, what is your earliest memory
right.
of the concept of work? So, like, when the concept began to take shape in your life?
I'd say it was something that men did, not women.
Okay.
It was something that consumed you at least 6 days a week. And sometimes seven.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that you brought home with you, just like my father would bring home piles of invoices and catalogs that he had to work with late in the evening. It was never questioned. No one ever said a bad word about it. I never heard my father complain once that work was trying or difficult or challenging. Never said a bad word about it. And it was inescapable. It's what adults did. And if you weren't working, then something was wrong. If you were an adult not working, something was wrong. If you're a male, right.
Yeah.
Women, when I was a kid, all the relatives that I knew, except for my aunt Pauline Fleischman, who had Pauline Fleischman's kitty shop on Del Mabry, South Del Mabry, all the women in my family were not working. They were stay-at-home moms.
Yep.
And that just seemed normal.
Yep.
I had a lot of learning to do when I moved up to Harvard, and I said to a young woman near Cambridge Common, can you tell me the way to Radcliffe? The female part, at that time, Harvard and Radcliffe were not yet combined as they are now. And she said, oh, I want to slug you. I said, what are you talking about? She said, every guy's been trying to pick me up, pretending to wonder where something is. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm not pretending. Gee, I didn't know that things were so politicized here. It didn't take long for me to see just how politicized women were in the Northeast, far more than anything I'd experienced in the South or in Florida. And I had to go through a revolution in my own understanding of what women did and what men did.
Well, those are wildly different.
Wildly different.
Worlds, right. Like, forever and for always, just North, South. I mean, New England in particular. And then, I mean, I can't imagine at the time how much greater. So what? Okay, so this is something that this is a concept of work takes on meaning that actually is really helpful as like a framing.
Right.
What about your own? So for you, like doing work.
Right.
Is it start with the shop, or is there something? And even not maybe just in employment sense, but like thinking of like school, sports, things that you worked at when right. you were young.
I think I saw, in terms of my father's store, I thought work was something I am obligated to do when he tells me. And it's not something that I would choose to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Eventually, one summer he had me working at Walgreens at West Shore Mall. I don't think there is a Walgreens there now, but there was in 1970 or 68 or something. And that just struck me as another example of what one has to do in order to be an adult, not what one wants to do. The idea of doing work that one wants was far from me, which is another reason why I thought I had to become a lawyer. I knew I loved to write, but I didn't think you could do what you loved. I thought you did instead what you could be good at, even if it wasn't deep in your heart. So one of the surprises living in Cambridge from 1971 to 1975 was to discover writers who were full-time writers.
Mm.
I never saw a single one of those in Tampa. And I thought, oh my goodness, I was wrong by the way, but I thought, oh my goodness, you can make a career as a writer. You don't have to do something else. That was a revelation. And I now believe, and I say this to my family members who ask or to my students, I say, find the thing you love and do that. Hmm. Someone said, it might have been Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, formerly chief rabbi of England or the United Kingdom. I think it's him. He said, find the thing that you love to do that matches something that needs to be done. When you find that, that is your life's work. What you love to do, which also fits the world's need.
Mm.
And what I love to do, it turns out, is writing and teaching. And I'm trying to make the writing fit the world's need more than I did when I started out, when I was mostly just trying to make a reputation for myself and trying to be shocking and upset the audience.
Yeah, so walk us through that a little bit. Like, so you move from Tampa up there. There's this, I mean, I imagine a huge culture shock, a huge, like, you're entering into this new world. You're experiencing, like, there's this revolution in, like, even your own frame that you're like, man, maybe this is a possibility.
Right.
Like, just kind of walk through the narrative a little bit of how you get from, you know, you can't do what you love, work is an obligation, it's something, you know, and right. Like, how does it transition to where you can go, I actually think that's what it is today. Like, take us on that journey a little bit.
You know, for me, my best life began when I moved to Harvard. I was not a very happy child in Tampa. I mean, I had the joys that any kid has or tries to have, and I had good friends in high school especially, but I was the smart kid in school in Tampa when it was not cool to be smart. And I remember a big revolutionary moment for me. I was in the boys' bathroom at Wilson Junior High, and I was in the stall, and two guys walked in, were at the sink, and they didn't know I was in the stall. And one said, Lieb's a good guy. He's smart, but he doesn't let you know it. And I thought, oh, that's the key. That's all I need to do in order to survive high school and junior high school, not speak up when I know the answer.
Mm.
And that, and in fact, I had a much better time when I pretended to be stupid than I ever had when I was raising my hand and answering the teacher's question. So I had learned by the time I got out of Tampa that being smart was a weakness or a bad habit that you had to hide in order to be accepted.
Hmm.
When I got to Harvard, the opposite was true.
Hmm.
They liked you if you were smart. They said good things about you, and you were surrounded by other smart people.
Yep.
And for me, and when I say smart, I don't mean wise. You know, I'm still working on being wise. Maybe maybe next week I'll get there.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
I'm just saying that in terms of book knowledge and so on, I was very driven.
Yep.
That was okay in Cambridge. And the revolution began within a few weeks of my moving up there. It was okay to be intelligent. It was okay to write intelligently. It was okay to talk intelligently. And there were people, intellectuals, who made a life out of being intelligent. I saw a lot of famous professors. In fact, one of the problems with Harvard is that they often give you a famous professor as a teacher instead of a good teacher. So the professor essentially teaches his latest book or her latest book, which you could have gone out and bought for a tenth of cost.
Yep.
And you don't really have any one-to-one relationship with them, and there are 300 people in the class, and they all just want to have a word with this famous person. So at the end of the class, they all run down to the lectern and try to ask some silly questions just so they can say that so-and-so spoke to me. This is one of the problems with what's called an elite education. There are definitely glories, but there are problems too.
Yeah.
So the revolution was not just a revolution in work. It was a revolution in understanding that my intellect might be useful to me in my adult life. And one of the ways to do that was to be a writer. Another way to do that was to teach. When I graduated in 1975 and went on to England, I had the idea that there were lots of people out there who were making a living using their heads, and that if I could do that, I could be happy. When I came back, and after those first wonderful experiences in the early 1980s, when I got to points where nobody cared that I wrote a play, nobody cared that I had a success last year, all they cared about was their present season, and it didn't include me, Then I realized that teaching was going to be the work that would keep me afloat.
Yeah.
Because the writing can't do it.
It's going to pay the bills.
It's going to pay the bills. And then it turned out I love teaching. I really do. I mean, I think it's so much, it's so beautiful and important to impart good values to your students and to introduce them to great works they would never have known about otherwise. Mm-hmm. I just read today in a Fiction 2 class, because the next fiction exercise that all the students have is due on next Tuesday. Today we had a free day, so I just read to them a great story by Delmore Schwartz called In Dreams Begin Responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And that's a story that once you have it, it's a story that stays with you your whole life. And it's just a pleasure to be able to introduce these things. But work now means to me helping students, communicating important ideas, and the only drudge part is sometimes when I am back home grading work and I have to grade some pieces which are very poorly written. I see it as my obligation to help that student not be a poor writer by the time they get out of my class. But my love of the English language is such that I can't help but feel a little pain when I see a common grammatical mistake made 20 times.
Yep.
So the irony is I'm doing the kind of brain work that makes me happy, but it also twists a little knife in me every time I see a student make some basic error.
Yep. Just grinds the gears or whatever. It's just nothing but pet peeves. And I mean, I can't imagine. Are you doing graduate level or are these undergrads?
These are undergrads.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine.
I changed my attitude about work with students a few years ago. When I first started teaching, my idea was I'll do the part I love, lecturing, talking to them about what to do and why to do it and when they have to do it. Mm-hmm. Then we'll workshop their short stories or their plays or their screenplays in class. Then I'll go home and I'll work on my own writing. So I've only had fun so far. Fun teaching and fun doing my own writing.
Yep.
As to going over their individual pieces, I would save that for the end of the semester.
It's your chores.
Then at the end of the semester, I would do a marathon of reading over 2,000 pages of student work, grading it, and getting it done within 2.5 weeks, get the grades in just in time, take a long breath out, and go back to
doing
what I love. Well, I don't think I was helping my students very much that way. I realized at a certain point that although I was allowing myself the time in the afternoons and evenings to write my own stuff, they were losing out because I was waiting till the end of the semester to grade their work.
They're not getting the feedback.
The only feedback they would get is the verbal feedback in class, and then they wouldn't get me staring at the page and pointing out errors and suggesting that they're doing something wrong or right. So I finally changed. And now I spend at least 2 hours at home every evening going over student work and making very detailed notes to help the students. And it's helping. I mean, I students who were turning in C work early in the semester, last semester, for example, were turning in A work at the end and thanking me for pointing out what they were doing wrong.
Oh, you can't overstate the value of that. Having a teacher that actually cares and is invested in seeing you kind of develop and grow. I mean, I think all of us could probably point to a teacher or two that shaped us forever because they paid attention.
Well, I'm doing that now and I'm glad I'm doing it, but it's eviscerating my creative work. I am finding I have very little time to do work on my own in the evening now. So ordinarily, or not ordinarily, back when I was doing it the original way, which I think was more selfish of me, I was able to come out with an 80-page play, let's say, over 3 months. Now, I've got a new novel, beyond the one that's being published in July. I've got a new novel I've written 100 pages of. I wrote it over the summer. And since work began at the university, I've made a total of 7 pages. Mm. That's months of work, 7 pages, because I just haven't had time. I've been focusing on the students.
So, okay, Because as you were saying that, I was thinking, wait, you have a novel coming out, and now you have another novel in the works. So, right. like, tell me and those listening a little bit about this novel that is coming out. And, oh, by the way, you just said you have this play and this novel this year.
Right.
At the same time, you're saying I'm putting all of this energy into the students. Like, it seems like maybe it's multiplying somewhere, like that it's actually quite a productive year.
It is a very productive year. Thank God. It's nice.
Thank God.
I've been through famine years also.
Okay.
So when the
feast, in terms of production
or in terms of nobody caring about my production, in terms of me having,
I have work, but nobody wants it.
Exactly.
Or, yeah.
You know, for example, my literary agent, I probably contacted at least 20 agents before one of them said, I like your book and I want to represent it. So going through the 19 that don't want it is difficult, you know. Everybody says that writers have to accept rejection as part of their work. But it's still rough to send out something you've been working on for years and being told, no, not interested, no, not interested, again and again and again. But anyway, this year they're interested. And the novel is called Image Breaker. And it's...
Quick question, yeah. Just before you say anything about it. You referenced iconoclast earlier.
Right.
And that's a similar word, right?
It is. I think iconoclast means image breaker.
Is related?
Yeah.
Okay, go on. That's what I was wondering.
All right, so I'll talk about that first. I talk about... The iconoclast in 1925 was the person who took everybody's religious and moral beliefs and showed that they were empty. You know, that's what a Bernard Shaw wanted to do.
Yeah, that's right.
Was to take the stolid, the conventional, the self-satisfied, and show them that there was a great abyss beneath them and that they weren't thinking clearly and that he wanted to shatter their ideas. By this time, the year in the 2020s, I want to say that the opposite is the truth. Right now, the iconoclast, in the old sense, is the convention.
Yeah.
That's what everybody does. My son, who's 21, is a natural iconoclast in that sense.
The deconstruction is the norm,
yes,
basically.
Yes, well said. Deconstruction is the norm. Everybody is a rule breaker. Everybody is an icon shatterer.
Yeah.
So it struck me that the truly difficult thing is to be religious. In this society.
Is to create icons.
Yeah.
right.
And that just as Ibsen's plays were banned in various countries because they were too iconoclastic, now it's hard to get a moral or religious work out there.
That's right.
Because what's really wanted is nihilistic, cynical, bright lights, big city, and then I took some cocaine, and then I did some ecstasy, and then I had promiscuous sex, and then I made $1 million, and then I had some more cocaine. That sort of thing sells.
Mm-hmm.
So my theory was the iconoclast is on the shoe is on the other foot now. I want to write a story about someone who becomes religious after starting out cynical.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to give that character as many problems as possible that he has to surpass if he's going to do it.
External, internal?
Both.
Yes, okay.
So I imagined a novelist. The guy's name is Tristan Wishnowsky. And Tristan is a famous American novelist who has made a career on his nihilism, his cynicism, his belief that there's no point to life, and all we can hope for is the void. He's totally devoted to this vision. And he's made a success of it. He's got a beautiful, intelligent lover. He's got best-selling novels. He shows up on TV all the time. He's got a great life by conventional standards. And one day, on page one of the novel, he's rereading Camus' The Myth of Sisyphus. About
a favorite. I'm in love with that book.
Well, life. well, as you remember, or as you know, Camus' point is that life is absurd, and that essentially we're all like Sisyphus in the myth, rolling a giant stone boulder up a hill, and when it gets to the top, it falls right back down, and we have to start again. And that was Camus' view of. That was his real philosophy. That was his view of life. I've read a couple biographies of Camus because I was so enamored of him in my early years. And he thought life was meaningless. You had to do your best in a meaningless universe. No God, no purpose, no foundation for moral life. All you had was your own conscience, and you had to use it well. But life itself was godless and void. So my character is rereading that in French, because he's a scholar who knows French and German.
Of course he does, yeah.
And suddenly, the lines on the page begin to part. One line goes up, another line goes down on the page, and in the middle he reads in English, "You know better than this."
Hmm.
So he thinks, that's weird, and he looks again, and the line is gone. So he keeps reading, and the lines part again. This time it says, "You don't have infinite time." He thinks, am I hallucinating? Am I not eating enough protein? What's going on with me? He keeps getting messages until finally one night in bed with his lover, he looks at the dial of his clock radio, and it says, "Search for me." He knows it's not a hallucination. He knows he's actually seeing it. And he goes to two people. He goes to a psychiatrist, a Romanian psychiatrist called Ion Petrescu, who doesn't believe in God but believes that there is a kind of universal mind which is behind all of existence and which wants our personal thriving. Then he goes to a rabbi, a female rabbi, and she thinks that he's been contacted by God. Mm-hmm. And she has an idea of some things he might do to discover whether, in fact, that's what's happened to him. And for the next 255 pages, he investigates every possible avenue that might explain to him why he's getting these messages and what changes he needs to make in his life.
Mm.
The images that he has to break are the images of the artist, because he's an artist, he's a novelist, and he's a sort of Cormac McCarthy type artist of violence and dread.
Mm-hmm.
He has to destroy that image. He has to destroy the image of himself as a Don Juan, because he's finally...
So good.
Thank you. He's confronted with the fact that there are women who are willing to love him, but whom he's not willing to love. He is willing to take them to bed, but not to love. So he has to shatter that image of himself. And in some sense, I felt I was shattering my own image. Anybody who knew me from my most successful play, the one that was done in Boston in 1980, would think that I was that kind of Bernard Shaw iconoclast. And I want to shatter that image and let people know that I believe in God. I believe in morals. I believe that there is a lawgiver and a law.
Yeah. Wow. So powerful. I have a specific question. It's a detail, actually, about the myth of Sisyphus.
Sure.
Because I'm wondering if I'm misremembering or if I'm right.
All right.
Isn't it, because I think your appraisal of the book is more or less right, but here's a punchline in my mind.
All right.
And I'm like, do I need to reread this book? So the question in my mind, here's the question I feel like I remember. God, right. I hope this is real. That the question is, can this character, Sisyphus, be imagined happy?
Yes, that's the last line of the book. We must imagine Sisyphus happy.
If you imagine him in love.
Right.
So the question of purpose and meaning and all of the things that are not, let's say, objectively available.
Right.
Are found in some inner state, right? This is how the book closes out. Is that right? Can be imagined happy.
He can be imagined happy.
If you imagine him in love. Like, this is a labor of love.
That's interesting. I don't remember that.
Because, by the way, I echo it to myself in all of my work all of the time.
Right.
Because I'm like, it's a labor of love. It is something that is ultimately meaningful because of a transcendent kind of love and call. Right. And anyway, I would have pointed to that book as like inspirational.
I like that. I hope that's what it says. And even if it doesn't say it, I think you're right.
Let's stick to that. Let's go with that.
Because yes, I mean, The Plague, Camus' novel after The Stranger, was about people living in a meaningless plague and having to be heroic in spite of the fact that there was no God to appeal to as far as Camus was concerned. There was only random evil.
Yeah.
And there are heroes in the plague. There are people who, out of love for humanity and for one another, rise to the level of hero, even though there's no, in Camus' world, there's no objective judge saying this person is heroic. Right.
You know, I've been a big fan of existentialism in general because of some of these themes, but I actually find them deeply related to my life of faith. But because you spoke about, like, you kind of lead to go, no, I want them to know, I want to shatter that image of me in that early play and say, no, I do believe in God. I do believe there's a lawgiver. I do believe in morality and that there is a code and an author of that code. I want to ask you, let's say theologically. Let me back up with the theme of the show here, like the work ethic. So Dorothy Sayers was a big part of the origin for me.
Right.
That kicked off this, like, thinking about our relationship to work. But also I taught a little summer school class to kind of some, like, a missionary community, that kind of takes pause over a summer. And I did this little course and I called it Developing a Philosophy of Work. And because it was a group of, you know, Christians, I was able to use scripture and I was like, oh, this is fantastic. And I want to dig into some of this. And like, and actually one of the things I really dug into was like the place of work, even in like the earliest story, like the Genesis narrative, right? Like this is like pre-fall condition kind right. of thing. This is something that was a gift. Given by God, not a result of the fall, right? Not a result of that.
Right,
Tending the garden, taking control and responsibility or dominion or whatever word right. you want to translate that. And so I want to ask you about, let's say, the philosophy of or the theology of work. Like, so I know I'll just leave it at that. Like, in your kind of like framework in your faith, like where do you find like vocation, calling, work, rest, leisure? I'm just wondering if you have like thought through this theologically or philosophically.
Right. Well, the Bible says you shall work for 6 days.
Yep.
And that tells me what is at least theologically acceptable and maybe mandatory, that one be working 6 days and rest on the seventh. I also find that leisure can be one of two things. It can be a useful relief that allows one to return to the work world refreshed, or it can be an excuse for doing nothing. And
yeah.
I have no problems whatsoever in going out and seeing a movie, going out and playing tennis, just hanging out for a few hours if I need that to get recharged.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have a whole lot of patience. I'm sorry to say this because I should. I don't have a whole lot of patience for the idea that a good day is a day spent playing video games all day.
Mm-hmm.
That strikes me as obscene. There are real dragons to fight.
Mm.
Poverty and hunger and cruelty and kidnapping and human trafficking, there are real dragons to fight. And to instead spend all day fighting imaginary dragons on the video screen seems to me a terrible dereliction of duty. Now, I also know that I'm not a great builder who can go to Habitat for Humanity and do a great job of building a house for them. My strengths are in my writing.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, combining the theology of work, which says that work is demanded or expected of you 6 days,
mm-hmm.
and the part that says, is there vocation? Somehow, for some reason, when I was 6 years old, I was already writing poetry.
Yep.
My vocation is to be a writer. I've got to put it together. I've got to put together the vocation that God has given me, which is to write, and the command to do justice and right wrongs and illuminate people,
yeah.
bring the truth to them. I see the whole thing as a religious quest now, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
The way I said it to myself several times is, Mark, you must bring your behavior up to the level of your values.
Mm.
And that's hard to do.
It's unbelievably hard to do.
Yeah.
But it'll keep you busy. it'll keep you busy. I mean, I don't know why this comes to mind, and I've shared this on here before, but like I have a annual kind of review process that I go through, and it's thorough. Like I spend almost all of December, like I go through every email, every calendar, I go through every social media, like everything that I can get. I print out I go through all this stuff, and it's very fruitful. It's like my favorite thing for the year. It's a discipline that I like really, really value. But every year, King said, a budget is a moral document, right? And every year I print out every credit card statement and every bank statement, and I grab a bunch of different color highlighters,
right?
And I go spend a day with it, and I go, what do I find that I value?
Right.
I'm never pleased.
Right.
And I usually come away and say, your God is your stomach. You know,
yeah.
When I actually look at, and when you say like, you got to get your behavior, like what, because a lot of what we, and this is the conviction that I have, is a lot of what we say we believe isn't true.
Right.
Like, no, you don't.
Yeah. Yeah. You think you believe it, but you think really it's propaganda. Believe it, you
That's
do
right.
It.
That's not what you do.
Yeah.
What you do is you go get chicken wings. Like, you know, it's like you don't. Your behavior doesn't map to it, but the effort, the like constant seeking, striving,
right.
like staying in the game.
Yeah.
Pushing the boulder.
Well, I must say, you know, John, you strike me as one of the people who does live up to the level of his values. I must say, you have done that with the well. You've done that with the well-built bikes. You're a role model as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. And I'll just say, you know, I always joke, like, my tombstone will read, he tried.
Right.
But that is the, and I'm happy with that. I'm happy with that. Like, that's what we can do.
I came across a great quote on this subject a few weeks ago. I was reading a book about Meister Eckhart, the Christian mystic.
Yeah.
And he was quoted, if I remember correctly, as saying, God is very close to us, but we are not very close to God. And what that meant to me, and maybe this is wrong, but what it meant to me is God knows exactly what we need. He knows exactly how we feel and what our thoughts are. But if we were close to him, we would do a lot different. We would do a lot of different things than we're doing. If we really were close to God, we wouldn't live the lives we're living.
A couple things that brings to mind, and I'm just like riffing here just because it brings them to mind, but like the first thing that comes to mind is there's an image in, I want to say it's in the book of Revelation and in the New Testament, that is like something like, behold, he stands at the door and knocks,
right?
And the image has always been really powerful to me, because what occurs to me is that the presence of God or Christ or however is standing on the outside of the locked door, right? Knocking. Like so when you say like God is close to you, but we are not, it's like that is the stranger, the other, the one that, like, we are the ones that have the, like, turn the deadbolt,
right?
That put him in that position, or like that we somehow have been given the grace or the honor to have the freedom to open that door or not.
No.
And yet he's never far, right? That seems the map. I mean, I'm a big fan of like mysticism in general, because I think it's helpful, because it blows out all of like what can be said about God. It's just like, it's really helpful to me, because it's so, it abstracts to a point where it's, I find actually like palatable and helpful, where it's right. Like, yeah, like everywhere and nowhere. And what can actually be said about this presence? And yet, and then we're going to write endless numbers of books trying to describe the ineffable.
Right.
There was another thing that came to mind when you said that, and it's lost on me now. Shoot. I have an idea. Actually, let me run this by you. Cause I feel like it's the one, I feel like this is, I think it's original or a contribution to a theological kind of conversation that takes place. So you're familiar with like the idea of orthodox, right? Like yep. orthodoxy. And it's just, so this is like right thinking, right?
Right.
Get your thoughts straight. And then, so in, you know, I'm a Christian, and in that, and that's the tradition I'm more familiar with. Although I think, you know, I was a religious studies major at USF. So I have some familiarity sure. with like an appreciation for many of them. There's plenty that we didn't learn about as well, because there's so many, but in that tradition, and it's probably maps to others, but I'm familiar with it in this Christian tradition. There comes along some theologians along the way. And like you referenced like, liberation theology before.
Right.
They go, hey guys, this is great. You got orthodox ideas. You got all like your behavior,
right?
Isn't mapping to your values, right?
Precisely.
And they go, hey, how about orthopraxis? How about you act right? How about you get your life straight? Like,
right?
And then there's work. Like, we need to be among the poor, and we need to be doing justice, and we need to engage in the, there's real dragons out here to fight,
right?
And so they prioritize action, which I appreciate.
Yeah.
Then some people come along and go, you know, there's this this quote from Apostle Paul or whatever is like something like, if I surrender my body to the flames but I don't have love, it's nothing.
Right.
And you know, your heart has to be right. Like, you have to feel something.
Yeah.
Like, sure, you can like give sandwiches to all these poor people, but does your heart break? Right, yeah. So there's orthopathos, let's say.
Yeah,
right.
Nice.
So there's, you're familiar with these three concepts, right?
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
Okay, so you got these three concepts,
right?
And there's conversation around these, like, they're all important, and there are camps. Like, when you realize, like, oh, some people prioritize this, others prioritize this, but like it all matters.
Right.
How you think, how you feel, how you act. This is like cognitive behavioral therapy, just like in a theological kind of abstraction or whatever. Sure. So I have this. So I started thinking about place, and I was trying to stick with this theme, like ortho, but I was using like in my mind I was like thinking proximity, but that's not how etymology works, because these are two different languages entirely. So I was right. like, well, what is the language like the is that Greek that would be place, and I looked it up, and it's topic. So like, and we use it this way, like you have a topical cream,
right?
You put it on the spot that needs the cream.
And utopia is no place.
Ah, yes. Right. So that's exactly, so that's the same word.
Right.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. So then I started conceptualizing this idea of orthotopic. Now I looked up the word.
Right.
And it does exist in the medical field. So
right.
it's the only place you'll find it. And it is basically, you get in a car accident and they go in and they inspect you and they go, the organ is orthotopic. It's where it belongs. Like, it's in the right spot.
Right. Never heard that before.
Yep. And it's used in medicine. So I found it. I was like, oh, that's the word. And it is used. But the conviction that I've had, and this is what I want you to like respond to. So I was laying that out as a framework, because this is like what feels like the thing that some conviction I have to like offer to this conversation is, I think the place fundamentally matters. And what I mean by this is the right, putting yourself in the right place. And for me, now I can't say for everyone, although I do want to, I feel like it's among the poor.
Right.
And this is why what you said before made me think of this, was like, God is near us, but we're not near God. You know, the poor are near us, but we're not near the poor. Right? Like,
right.
The suffering is near us.
Right.
But we don't get near to suffering. In fact, all of those things we turn our eyes, we want to stay away from. And I have this conviction that like the place, if you put yourself in the place, like literally among them, among hurting people, suffering people, poor people,
right.
oppressed people. And you know, there's like so many stories of like, I don't know, St. Francis living among lepers, is that how you say that? Lepers?
Yeah.
And actually, it's my understanding is at some point they'd be like, oh, it's so good what you do for these lepers. He's like, no, you have no idea what happened here. Like, they saved my life. They welcomed me in.
Right.
Like, I am made whole by them, right? And so my conviction is that the place is right. And if you put yourself in the right place, it will break your heart.
Yeah.
You will it will demand righteous action, and you will have the vantage point of the poor, which will help you think straight.
Right.
Anyway, there you go. That's my, like, this is something I've been thinking about for years. Yeah. And just feel like.
That's great. The Jewish perspective on something similar to that is do the right thing. The heart will come along.
And actually, I think this is right. That actually maps to, like, cognitive behavioral therapy as well. It's like, no, just act it out. Like, sure, you don't feel that way just yet. Just
you
do
will.
It.
You will.
That's fine. Do the right thing. That actually is right. Yeah. I'm not saying if you don't feel it, don't do it. No, you should do it. Yeah. Right. That's better than not doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Okay, so you mentioned before, I'll keep an eye on the clock here. Okay, I think we're good. You mentioned the second, so it sounds like your first play ever was the most successful play.
Yes.
In your kind of,
I've had productions off Broadway in Chicago, several in Tampa, St. Petersburg, but the one that got the Newsweek review, the one that got the most publicity.
Was your debut.
Was my debut.
That's amazing. So then you said, I started working on another one.
Right.
Encyclopedia of
Culpepper. Encyclopedia Culpepper.
And you said, I couldn't make it work.
Right.
Couldn't make it work. And I wanted to come back to that and ask, like, what does that mean?
What it means to me now was I didn't believe in what I was writing. And because I didn't believe in it, I couldn't finish it. The way a story or a play ends is usually the key to its meaning. And I couldn't bring this to an end because no matter what end I thought of, I didn't believe it.
Like it felt inauthentic or dishonest.
It felt dishonest and inauthentic, yes.
Which actually comes to something you said, you're like, I want to tell the truth.
Right. I want to tell the truth. I think that's what...
And you have to tell the truth.
Yeah. And when you go to dental school, you become an expert at dentistry so that someone who doesn't have time to go to dental school can go to you and get their tooth filled.
Yeah.
Well, I think the writers should take the attitude about seeking truth. People don't have time. They're too busy being dentists to go search philosophy. So they go to the theater on Saturday night to get some truth.
Yeah.
And your job as the writer is to provide that truth, which means that you, the writer, are on a necessary quest to learn the truth for the rest of your life. It never stops.
You know, there are movies, so I'm mostly familiar with movies, right? Sure. It's like in terms of narrative, but I know you do screenplay, and there are movies that I love.
Right.
That I still am irritated by because I think they're lying. So I'll give you an example. Are you familiar with the movie Limitless?
No.
So it's about a pill that this guy can take. It makes him like smarter than anyone. And he's like a dodo bird, but then he takes this pill and he's like, I mean, he just crushes. He's like the most successful. He can do math better than anyone. He think better. He can plot strategy. So he takes over in stock market business. I mean, he just does it all. But it's a drug, so it's like has downs and then like addiction and this, that, and the other. And it's funny because I think about this movie and I actually really like the movie and I really want to kind of believe the movie. And guys, spoiler alert for those that haven't seen it, but like he basically games it. So it's destroying him. But in the end, he's so smart when he's on it that he figures out a way to game it, to use it perpetually and like live happily ever after kind of thing, which just bothered me, right? Like as a punchline of the movie, I was like, I think it's supposed to kill you. right? That's the price you pay for this deal with the devil that you've made the whole plot. But like, I don't know if that, anyway, sorry for the tangent of that, but like it's the movie that comes to mind where I go, I'm not sure that movie told me the truth.
Right. Yeah. And there are truths. There's a line I was just talking about with a friend of mine last night who's visiting from New York, a line in Dostoevsky where Ivan Karamazov says, I can believe in God, but I cannot believe in this world.
Mm.
I think that's a truth so deep that it'll stay with me all my life. Mm-hmm. Yeah, God is easier to believe that there is a creator, that there is a source, than to believe some of the stuff that's happening right now in Tampa. Some of that stuff is beyond credulity.
Which that's from the Grand Inquisitor section of Brothers Karamazov.
Probably.
And he, interestingly enough, he says, and so I'm going to turn my ticket back in. Like, right, I reject God, not because I don't believe in God. I believe in God. But I'm out.
Because of
the cost of one life, one baby.
One child's life, right.
One child's life is not worth the ticket of admission or whatever. He says, the line in that that made me shudder was, I'll take my cup and smash it on the ground.
Yeah.
And it just, that's a powerful read.
Well, that's something any religious person has to deal with. How do you explain to yourself, if no one else, the existence of suffering in a world that is run supposedly by a good God? And for me, it's belief in an afterlife. I believe that everything is rectified eventually.
Interesting.
If one doesn't believe in an afterlife, I don't know how one can explain the suffering of that 5-year-old child or some child that was killed in the earthquake in Turkey that I read about in the Times yesterday.
Earlier, you said that you believe in a moral code.
Yeah, a moral code.
A moral law.
Yes.
This isn't an answer to that question. I don't think anyone can make a simple answer to that. It's the Odyssey is the hardest of questions.
Right.
However, I kind of think that the problem that you have with evil.
Right.
I don't know if this makes sense, but it feels circular. It's like, wait, well, what's the problem? Why is there a problem with it? Like, what are you standing on to say that it's a problem?
Right.
You have to stand on something like a moral law
in order to say it's a problem.
So it's like the very foundation that you stand on to make the rejection is the ground of being by which you're able to do that. Like it feels like that was enough of a trick to stump me that I couldn't riddle my way past that, where I was like, well, because if it is just life is suffering and it's meaningless and we're alone, like these are the existential givens,
right?
You know, and well, then it's just like, well, then it's just suffering and death consciously waiting your impending doom.
Right.
And then it's a wrap. Like, it's like watching, you know, lions rip each other apart on Nature Channel. It's like, well, that's just nature. What's the problem with that?
Yeah, Pascal.
It's something, it's beautiful.
Pascal in the Pensée has one. His image of the human condition is a bunch of people waiting to be called out to be executed, one after the next. And Malraux made that a scene in his book *Man's Fate*, basing it on the Pascal Pensée.
Oh man, I don't know that.
But I mean, I don't accept it. I don't believe that. I don't believe that we're just waiting for our execution. I think that we have a. I don't know that this has to do with work, but
sure.
Since we're talking,
I do. It's okay.
At certain moments, I suspect that the world, the Earth, is a rehab place for morally challenged people.
Well, fair enough.
And that's why everybody's so problematic.
Yeah.
Because if you weren't, you'd be having fun in heaven right now.
Mm.
But if you get to Earth, it means there was a problem. And our whole purpose is to become morally accomplished adults. And if that happens, then we do indeed go to an afterlife that is quite pleasant.
I'm curious, and you can stay on this or not, it's totally up to you, but I am curious about the development of afterlife in Judaism. Where does that begin?
There's only one reference to it in the Torah, or in the Jewish Bible, in the book of Daniel.
Daniel.
Aside from that, most of the references to the afterlife just talk about a place called Sheol.
Sheol,
which
is
some kind of underground, very dreary place that the dead people go to.
Place of the dead.
Yes.
Yep.
However, by the time Torah evolves into Talmud, which is, say, between 200 BCE and 500 CE, there is a quite expansive view of the afterlife, where there is heaven and hell, where there are seven levels of heaven and seven levels of hell, and where again and again the great rabbis who interpreted the Torah into the Talmud make it absolutely clear that while we don't know for sure what the afterlife is like, it is so good that 1 hour of it is better than the entire life on Earth.
Yeah, and so that idea there is something like a progressive revelation, that it's like, yeah, we don't have that in our oldest texts, but like we've kind of built upon the tradition and kind of, yeah. Well, so here's the thing is, you're like, I don't know if this is related to work. So at some level, I do think that, and maybe I've never, I don't know if that, this is a great conversation for me, because I'm like, it's pushing me to try to like say why I think this is related. Like, I think life is work. And I think that, and by which I mean we sacrifice, we struggle, we have to aim at something, and move toward that and sacrifice toward that. And then I think that, and like you said about leisure, I think rest is the fruit of work.
Right.
Like, you know, when you finish a job, you do a job and you like go take a nap or go see a movie or get some dinner. It's like, that is rest. And actually rest, that the leisure that you talk about, just kicking it all day and not working, is like, I actually think that's a form of restlessness. Like, it's, that's not what rest is. Right. But because of all this, I think part of the work of life is like to make, like, there's a lot, even just this theological conversation, is a lot to make sense of.
Right.
And there's real work to be done to go, all right, I'm going to continue. I'm going to play this game. I'm going to see this through. And I just think at some fundamental level, like, the expression of human freedom is responsibility, is like, right, to go, yeah, you're free. And what you do with that's actually like really matters.
Right.
To the point of almost being paralyzing. It's like some of the existentialists, like, there's like that's almost crippling or absurd in its weight.
Have you ever heard of the Christian theologian John Hick? H-I-C-K.
It rings a bell, but nothing comes to mind from that.
He wrote a book with a title something like Suffering and the God of Love. And he's most famous for his discussion, his theodicies, why is there suffering?
Mm.
And his theory, which he develops quite beautifully in several essays that I've read and in this book as well, is that God wants people in heaven who are morally developed in a way that a person who is naturally good is not. So that if you have had to conquer fear to become courageous, that is a higher level of courage than if you were just born courageous and did it without any problem.
I think that's right. That relates to, like, this is, there's a re, like, the whole, I it's almost a cliche, but like the idea that this is the best of all possible worlds, like the because, so I could just say myself, like, you see these scars and like my car accident,
right,
the hardest, most horrible thing I've ever been through.
Right.
It's the best thing that's ever happened to me. Like, and why? I actually, what's that?
Why was it the best thing?
Because it shook the shit out of me.
Right.
It made me face death, the questions of God and meaning. It made me acquainted with suffering or like really to know pain in a way that, like, when I see it, I feel it.
Right.
In a way that made compassion not like a concept, but like something that's like, no, I know what it is to be smashed, to be in the grip of death, to be in excruciating pain, to be completely outcast. Like, because after that accident, I'm like the kid in the wheelchair with the mouth wired shut, like when they stuck me back in school, and all of that, which is horrific, by the way. I wouldn't wish this on anybody.
Right.
And yet, and I wouldn't, if you were going through it, I wouldn't say, hey, in the end,
you'll be glad.
This is so good for you. Yeah, no, you would never say such a thing,
right,
because of, well, just wisdom, compassion, care. However, I believe, and I wonder if this is true for you, for me, the hardest things I've ever been through, the worst things, this is related to why I think being among the poor and being in the presence of suffering is so important, is it's like they're the things that are so horrible, so evil, even, let's say, whatever word, tragic.
Right.
Tragedy and evil aren't quite the same, but like, right, they're converted. They're like turned into like, there's actually a philosopher that I interviewed on here, Jerome Miller, that I could send you a link to, but he actually used the language of they're turned into a fountain,
right?
Of I forget the word he used, but like that they pour out goodness. And like, so you referenced dragons before, right? Well, mythologically, when you fight them, there's gold. Right. Like that actually is the like outcome. It's like you come out of this is the hero's journey, right? You come out of hell,
right,
with a newfound sense of self, purpose, presence, and all of that to me is like, you know, the thing that made me go, God, if there is a God, it's just a place to point my middle fingers. That was the initial move after my car accident. Is like, if there's a God, I want nothing to do with God because you let this happen to me,
right?
Because you're supposed to be good and care about me and love me. And then ultimately, this is like the just things that just shape me out of things like St. John on the Cross, like Dark Night of the Soul. It's like the most loving presence of God that I've ever experienced is the deepest pain I've ever been in. And I don't know how to like articulate that right. But it's the best thing that's ever happened to me. I am who I am and I do what I do and I care about what I care about because I smashed my face in that windshield.
It's kind of astounding.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I just I don't know and I don't think it's like an idiosyncrasy. I don't know if that's the right word. What's the right word for that? Like, I don't think it's me.
Yeah.
I actually think it's like how it works.
Right.
A little bit.
But some people, unfortunately, take the opposite attitude. Something bad happens and they say there can be no God because that wouldn't have happened if there was a God. I mean, we have to admit that as much as we want to believe, and I do believe with you, that difficulty exists to help us craft our souls. There are a lot of people who run away from God.
That's right.
Because of difficulty. And that's, you know, if you care about people and you love some of these people, it's a problem.
Yeah.
You know?
It is a problem. And interestingly enough, I do think it is. I actually would affirm that move in a strange way. That image of God needs to die.
Needs to be replaced,
right? It's not, it's a lie, like that benevolent father in the sky that would never let you bruise your knee,
right?
Isn't real. Like that's not how it works,
right?
And I do think, but like I don't know where this quote comes from. When you're going through hell, keep going.
Yeah.
But like people don't come out the other side of that. Like that's the end of the story. And that is tragic.
Right.
Actually, that like there isn't and I don't know what to say. It's not like, oh, I figured something out. It's like, no, something happened to me and I somehow survived and persevered through the other side of that. And consider it grace.
Yeah.
Consider it grace. I don't know what else to point to in that, but it is somehow related to my thoughts about work and why I think like there are things we're suffering for. There's things we're struggling for and sweating for. Okay. I know we're kind of coming up on time and I want to make sure I ask you a few other questions.
Sure.
So you said, was it Terry by Terry?
Yeah.
Was a big success.
Right.
And then even in this life, and so that's, but I'm singling out the word success.
Right.
And then even in kind of life of faith and, you know, getting your behavior to the place of your values. Right. I want to like take the word success, both with the play.
Yeah.
And your life of faith.
Right.
What I just want to ask you, like, what is success?
That's the whole question. That's like, what's the point of living?
Yeah.
I think it means to be living a spiritual life.
Mm-hmm.
I think it means to love. It's also nice to be loved.
Yeah.
But at least to love.
Yeah.
And I think it means doing work which is a benefit to the community.
Hmm.
Those three things. if you are famous for making a great zombie movie, which was the grossest zombie movie ever and had more blood and gore than any previous zombie movie, so much so that it has entered the ranks of the great zombie movies.
Yeah.
That's not success.
Okay.
If you...
I love this.
If you've helped a beggar on a street corner with a dollar, that's success. Mm. And if you love your family, if the work that you're doing is a contribution to a troubled world and not an exacerbation of its troubles, that's success. Mm. The problem is, this society tells us that's not true.
I know.
And we are told that the guy who made the zombie movie belongs on the cover of the magazines, and he belongs in the news feed, and his income is proof of his greatness. And it's very hard to unlearn that. Mm. I have to struggle with that.
You know, interestingly enough, I mean, I don't know, it's just like, because we're zombies?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like walking dead people.
Yeah.
I don't know why that like just tickled me a little bit with that, just you using the zombie example. But so let's kind of bring this home. But like, is there anything for those listening that you want to point them to?
Yeah.
Ask of them ways that they can get in touch or ways that they can get your book. Just kind of.
For the play, it's StageWorks in Tampa. There's a website, StageWorks Tampa. It runs March 17th through the very 1st of April on weekends. It's called When the Righteous Triumph, and it's very close to what really happened in Tampa in 1960, and it's worth knowing. The novel is called Image Breaker. It's published by Vine Leaves Press. It comes out in July of this year, 2023. I don't know the exact date yet. And it should be available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all those. If I had to tell the reader what to read, I would say there's a wonderful two-volume book called A Code of Jewish Ethics, which has made an enormous difference in my life.
Really?
A Code of Jewish Ethics by Rabbi Joseph Telushkin, Telushkin. And it is reader-friendly. It is not some cold list of rules. It's a book of anecdotes and jokes and stories, and I love it, and it's made a great difference in my life.
I need to start asking people for a book suggestion.
Yeah, that'd be great.
This is so good. Is there an audio version?
There might be.
There might be. I'm going to have to look that up. Thank you so much, man. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your work.
Thank you, John.
I can't wait to bring this crew to come see When the Righteous Triumph. And I hope everyone listening will come join us.
Thank you very much. You are a blessing to this community. And the work that you've done is some of the most important work that anyone in this time has done. And I'm so conscious of your significance and the pivotal place that you exist in. Thank you.
Man, I appreciate you so much.